This is the Tribe and Dish Podcast,
part of the 16 Win the Ring Network.
Talking about NBA news, stats, and fantasy.
We hadn't even started yet!
To start it off, it's Tim Tompkins.
Part of what makes him such a good defender is his ability to switch, his ability to contest that three-point shot even when he is 7 feet away from it to run out and close out on the shooter.
Kevin Rayfuse.
If Russell Westbrook averages a triple-double for the season and his team makes the playoffs, I don't know how it can be anyone other than him.
And Justin Kuzite.
I know, I just feel like they got this guy and he's just been injured since. Like, I'm curious to see how they work him into lineups. Like, they've gotten so used to not having him. Like, how do they end up using him?
The Drive and Dish Podcast.
We start right now.
So we've been doing a lot of round tables or special episodes, it feels like, for the past almost like 2 or 3 weeks at this point. I know you guys, Kevin, you guys did a round table last episode. And then before that, we did, you know, not so emergency podcasts on DeMarcus Cousins and, you know, all the other trades that kind of went down before the trade line. But, you know, the trade deadline just happened and we felt as if it would be wrong for us not to pull out another special episode. We are pulling off a special baseline and Drive and Dish podcast roundtable. So we brought in the hosts from Baseline, Cal Lee and Warren Shaw. Guys, thank you so much for joining us.
Appreciate it, man.
So I don't know about you guys, on the exact day of the trade deadline, I'm sitting at work because we work early. And not only am I just glued to Twitter looking for Woj to drop some bombs on the Twitter world, but I'm also watching, and I want to know if this is as big as it was down here as it is for you guys where you guys are, but this April the Giraffe, who's live streaming her birth, well, I guess she's not, the zookeepers are live streaming her birth. It's going on like 5 days now, I'll be honest. She still hasn't given birth as of recording this podcast. Have you guys been as intrigued by this as me before we get into the basketball stuff?
I'm going to say no, because I didn't even know that was happening.
Oh, okay, great. So it's just me. Great, okay.
Then back to China, and she was having difficulty eating bamboo, so... While I try to keep up with the Joneses when it comes, you know what I'm saying, to the animal kingdom of things, right. And I didn't know about April the Giraffe, and I'm hoping that all things go well, and, you know, I don't know what they call, like, a C-section for, you know, giraffes giving birth or whatever the case may be. I hope it's much smoother sailing than I think what we've seen from this past NBA trade deadline.
Right. I guess I'll ask you guys before we get into the big trades. I know you guys, I think one of the first times we guys had you on, we talked to you guys a lot about the Celtics. So before we get into the actual trades that happened, I want to ask you guys your thoughts. And Warren, we'll start with you. Warren, what are your thoughts on the Celtics not making any big splashes at this deadline?
Well, my thing about the big splash is I understand it. If you go by reports, and none of us are in the room, we don't understand exactly what's being discussed, but some of the reports out there, especially the one for Paul George, seem to be really astronomical for Danny Ainge to pay. If you're asking for three of his top four rotation guys plus the 2017 pick, which is probably going to be a number one or number two pick, giving you a chance at Alonzo Ball or Markelle Fultz, then that did seem to be a bit pricey. And I understand from Boston's standpoint where they have assets that they can afford to lose, per se, and they can take a hit on a trade. They don't absolutely have to win it to get better. But at the same time, it seemed like a lot. Now, the backside of that, though, is just, you know, last night I texted CL kind of late after they took that loss to Toronto, and it's like, I felt like they should have made a smaller move, you know, something to help them with rebounding and rim protection. If Nerlens Noel was available for basically essentially a late first rounder, which is probably going to turn to a second round pick and an expiring contract, that's the move they should have made, or even trying to just trade for Andrew Bogut as opposed to letting hit the buyout market. So them not making the move to get Paul George or Jimmy Butler, I get, but, you know, like I said, not making any move at all, I'm a little uneasy for them regarding that.
I was going to say, when you mentioned the Noel, and we'll get into that, I'm going to, when we do, I'll hand the baton over to Kevin and just let him set fire to whatever he wants to set fire to, because
I'm burning it down.
His face was not happy. But Cal, I guess I ask you, would you, you know, because we did see the Celtics play the Raptors in the first game back the other night, and it seemed like the Raptors really kind of figured it out. DeRozan went off. So, you know, are you in agreements with Warren that you think maybe they should have made a move to get a smaller player, or do you think they should have pulled the trigger on a Jimmy Butler or a Paul George-esque type player and really given him the asking price?
Well, look, the way that I looked at this is, if you're the Boston Celtics and you essentially are leading the Atlantic Division, and you've just seen the Toronto Raptors make a play 3-4 days prior to the trade deadline and getting Serge Ibaka, clearly the writing is on the wall that your competitors, you know, and let's just keep it 100 on this, your competitor at this moment in time really is not the Cleveland Cavaliers. Your competitor is the Toronto Raptors. You're trying to position yourself to get the highest seed possible. Now, leading up to the NBA All-Star break, essentially the Boston Celtics had the best record, right, minus a couple of games, give or take. And for you to not pull off any kind of moves whatsoever, even the Cleveland Cavaliers, who are already being touted as the team coming out of the Eastern Conference that everyone is chasing, pulled off some kind of move, or whether it be pickups via through waivers, whatever the case may be, the fact that you're the Boston Celtics and you're just standing pat and you don't even make a play to bring some kind of piece to enhance your basketball team, to me, is an indictment on Danny Ainge. And I think that this is going to, you know, reap a whirlwind should the Boston Celtics fail to meet expectations, which in this particular sense is, if they accumulate the second highest or even the highest total of wins in the conference but can't get out of the first or even the second round, people are going to look back to what they didn't do as much as what they should do. Now, I get it. You don't want to get Paul George. You don't want to get Jimmy Butler. No problem with that. If you don't feel like those are the pieces to get you to an NBA Finals, I get that. And there's no assurances that they're going to re-sign. I get that. But to not get a guy like Tyson Chandler, to not to make a play to get somebody to help bolster that front court, just is egregious. And then last night was a perfect example of why exactly the Boston Celtics are going to fall short of where I think people think that they should be because of what they just didn't do by the trade deadline.
Yeah, I think, you know, that maybe they were overvaluing that pick that they're holding on to from the Nets. It kind of seemed like they were really thinking that's going to, although they are saying this draft is going to be huge, they kind of were holding that to a specific level. And we always talk about, if you are going to try to compete, is bringing in rookies who are going to need to develop the way to go, I guess.
And again, real quick, I said, I think that's an excellent point for Boston. And, you know, the Celtics fans base is very torn in terms of, like, well, we're trying to win now and win later, blah, 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 blah. And if you have, but these guys are supposed to be transgenerational, if you will, you know, in terms of these top two guys, at least for sure. They may not need as much time to develop, so I think that's what Boston's thinking is. But again, I agree with, you know, kind of the whole content of the conversation here in terms of that. So they should have did something. Now, they still have a chance. They could, you know, a lot of talk about Terrence Jones potentially as a buyout candidate. They still have a chance at Bogut, but chances are he probably goes to Cleveland or Houston ahead of Boston. So they have a chance to make some minor moves, but yeah, they missed the boat a little bit, and they're going to end up paying for it come playoff time.
I saw a bunch of people saying, watch Bogut go to the Cavs and pull an Anderson Varejao and just kind of, like, suck in the playoffs and be like a secret agent. I think that would be pretty funny. You know what time it is. It's time for us to talk to you about the absolute best app for buying any kind of tickets anywhere, the SeatGeek app. It's the smartest way to buy tickets for your basketball games. You can see live up close this season. There's nothing like being in the building for the biggest games of the year. And with SeatGeek, it's never been easier. You can get the guaranteed seats you want for a great value. I know you've heard about Luke Bryan canceling all the vendor tickets. Don't go to them. Go to SeatGeek. They really do want to help you get the most bang for your buck. That's why every ticket on SeatGeek is given a grade based on value. You will see green if it's good, red if it's bad. Plus, every ticket you buy on SeatGeek is backed by their 100% guarantee. Again, bringing it back to Luke Bryan canceling those vendor tickets, that would totally suck to show up to a game and your ticket is not an actual ticket. Best thing of all, though, the Drive and Dish listeners are getting $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase. All you gotta do, download the SeatGeek app. It is free in the App Store. Go to the Settings tab and click Add a Promo Code. Enter the promo code DISH, D-I-S-H, as in drive-in dish. And when you buy your first ticket, you will get $20 off immediately. So don't ever say we never did anything for you, all right? The SeatGeek app, go get it now in your app store. So we'll switch over to, you know, you kind of mentioned it and alluded to it. The Raptors were very active, obviously bringing in Serge Ibaka. But the other one that I know Tim probably has a little bit of feelings towards, because I know he's a big P.J. Tucker fan. The Raptors did go out and get P.J. Tucker for 2 second-rounders, and I believe they sent Jared Solinger as well. So, Tim, I ask you, how do you feel about this for, you know, as a Suns fan, and how do you think it's going to impact the Raptors going into the playoffs and how they match up with maybe the Cavs or, you know, maybe the other teams like the Wizards and the Celtics that they'll possibly run into in the finals or in the playoffs?
Well, I think if you're looking at it from a Suns perspective, and look, it was an absolute funeral for Suns fans yesterday. P.J. Tucker is the longest tenured Sun. He embodies everything about the organization the Suns fans love: grit, grind. He's an absolute monster on the defensive end. He can guard 1 through 5. Every single night, P.J. Tucker guards the best player on the opposing team, and it doesn't matter if it is Anthony Davis, if it is Blake Griffin, if it is Kawhi Leonard, if it is LeBron James, or if it is Kyrie Irving. He straight up is one of the top 5 defenders in the league. Looking at it from the Raptors' perspective, the Raptors went all in, and the Raptors are trying. Serge Ibaka is an upgrade over any power forward they've been playing all season. They shipped off Jared Solinger, who wasn't part of the future. They're going to handicap themselves a little bit going into this offseason as far as from a financial perspective. But adding a player like P.J. Tucker, who, you know, even though Damari Carroll has been hitting a stride recently, P.J. Tucker is an excellent player that does exactly what they brought Damari Carroll in to do. I mean, just look at last night, where I was listening to the Zach Lowe podcast prior to the Celtics Raptors game, and I think it was Brian Windhorst that said P.J. Tucker wasn't going to be that good of a get for the Raptors because he was just going to be playing 12 minutes a game. And being somebody that's watched P.J. Tucker for the last 5 years, I just thought that's absolute garbage. P.J. Tucker is the kind of player that helps you win, and you look at what he did last night. He played 29 minutes compared to Damari Carroll's 27 minutes. He was a positive 11 on the floor. The value that he brings, and right now the Raptors are a dangerous team, and they have their eyes on the Cavaliers with Serge Ibaka, you know, locking down Kevin Love with P.J. Tucker and Damari Carroll splitting the duties on LeBron James. And if you're one of these other teams, whether you're the Celtics or you're the Wizards, I think you want to avoid playing the Raptors almost as much as you want to avoid playing the Cavaliers.
My first thought was, you know, I know they brought in Damari Carroll to be that LeBron James S type stopper, but, you know, Damari Carroll probably can't be on the court as long as LeBron James, so now they bring in P.J. Tucker and kind of just tag team it out, and once one gets tired, throw the other one on him, right?
P.J. Tucker's a better defender.
So maybe P.J. Tucker starts on LeBron. I'm assuming they brought him in for that, not specifically, but kind of specifically.
Well, that, and they also, I mean, look, the Raptors have, their defense has been awful, and they went and they addressed a need in getting 2 defensive-minded players. And the great thing about these players, too, isn't just that they're defensive-minded, but they can score a little bit, too. I mean, P.J. Tucker's not exactly a huge two-way player, but he can camp out on the corner and hit the corner threes all day long. Mm-hmm. Serge Ibaka has a nice mid-range game. So, you know, they got players that are two-dimensional, and that also gives them a lot of flexibility in lineups going into the postseason. If they want to play small, they can put Serge Ibaka at the 5 and play P.J. Tucker at the 4. I do think this is really interesting from a Valanciunas perspective going into the offseason, because they aren't going to have all that much money. How likely are they to keep Valanciunas in this example?
I know Raptors fans aren't, I mean, they're fans of him, but when we talked to Tamberlin, she kind of made it sound like Raptors fans weren't the biggest fans of Valanciunas.
No, he's a 14-10 guy.
Yeah. So, you know, just before we move on, I'll just kind of go around to, you know, we'll start with Kevin, and then we can go to Warren and Cal, and then you. How do you think, and do you think Cavs, I'm trying to think of the right way to word this. Obviously, the Cavs are the favorites, but do you think with what the Raptors have done, they've put themselves either on the same level as the Cavs or above the Cavs? Do you really think they have a legitimate chance of beating them? Kevin, we'll start with you, and then we'll jump over to Warren and Cal.
The short version is they got a lot closer to beating the Cavs, and I think they'll be able to push the Cavs more than they ever have before. but I don't think they're going to get past the Cavs. I mean, really, the only thing that's holding the Cavs back, especially if they bring Deron Williams in, is Kevin Love's knee. And if you go by the interviews and the media availability he's had so far post All-Star break, he says he's still on that 6 weeks recovery, which would get him back for the playoffs, which is big. I do think the Raptors have definitively jumped the Celtics as they didn't make a move. And I know the Wiz got Bogdanovich, but I just don't think there's enough firepower now to go with Toronto. The biggest thing for me is just got to be Lowry and DeRozan in the playoffs. You know, we've seen the last 2 years they've been there. The shots haven't been falling. The ones that they're making during the regular season, just, you know, well below 40%. And so you have to wonder, you know, they rely so much on these two guys scoring. And Ibaka helps a little bit in that regard. Like Tim just said, he can give you some offensive help. But at the same time, and while you have PJ Tucker as a defensive guy, you know, so much of this still is reliant, with Valanciunas not taking that next step, on DeRozan, on Lowry. I want to see it to the next level. But, you know, the Raptors went all in. We said this is something we feel like they had to do. This was their, you know, that window is so small with them. You got to take the chance. You know, you can't just kind of stay where you were at, because if they didn't make any type of moves, I think the Cavs would be definitively better. But I think they're going to push the Cavs. I think the Toronto Raptors are the definitive second best team in the Eastern Conference now. They've reaffirmed that level despite the slump. But I'm just not ready to pick against LeBron James in the Eastern Conference.
Yeah, one of the things that I look at with this Toronto Raptors team is they kind of move like how the stock market moves, right? And there are times where I think amongst us, the people on the outside, we don't know whether or not we want to stay all in with these guys or if we want to sell short on them. From what they've done for the trade deadline, they have certainly replanted themselves to be the top team in the Atlantic Division and ultimately likely to be the second seed, or unless something drastically happens to the Cleveland Cavaliers, like, you know, they rip Van Winkle their way through the rest of the season and concede to the number one overall seed, the likelihood is it's going to be probably Toronto 1, Cavs 2, or Cavs 1, Raptors 2, right? So that to me is what they're – it's and obviously necessary for the Toronto Raptors, because they're going to need home field advantage at least leading up to, if not getting to the Eastern Conference Finals. The problem that I'm seeing with this basketball team, and again, they did what they needed to do in order to maintain where they came from last year, is that this basketball team relies very heavily on DeMar DeRozan and Kyle Lowry from an offensive perspective. And while getting Serge Ibaka and getting P.J. Tucker are great defensive complementary pieces, when the Cleveland Cavaliers begin to force the tempo, do the Toronto Raptors have the ability and the versatility to run with the Cavs? Because then now it becomes an offensive foot race. And it's just, when you look at this roster, it's not built like that. DeMar Carroll is not living up to the money that they've paid him. And even if you give me a P.J. Tucker, you're not asking P.J. Tucker to sacrifice defense in order to play offense when the Cavaliers decide to start running their offense more efficiently and fluently. It's going to come down to DeMar DeRozan and Kyle Lowry stepping up and basically playing like how Kyrie Irving played in the NBA Finals to pair up with LeBron James when he stepped his game up against the Golden State Warriors. And I'm just not realistically seeing that, because unfortunately this team still does not match up for matchup. They don't seem – they're not at that level, or they'll never probably get to that level that we've seen when the Cavaliers decide to take it up a notch. And I think more than anything else, I keep saying it, for some reason I just get this sense that with this roster, the Raptors have tapped out to their potential, and they're going to have to make some kind of drastic changes in the offseason. But they address these immediate needs to at least give themselves – a puncher's chance for this upcoming NBA playoff.
Yeah, I was going to say, it definitely seems like another thing that I know the Raptors can focus on, and specifically, I know the Cavs are like top three in three-pointers per game or three-pointer attempts per game, so I know the three-point defense specifically will be important.
I'm going to echo the comments of both Kevin and CL there. I think, you know, obviously the Raptors have made a small stride forward, or even if you say a big stride, and the health of Kevin Love is massive for their overall, you know, development in terms of trying to get out of the Eastern Conference. That said, I think there's a very good point in terms of, we know what Lowry and DeRozan are at least supposed to do when it comes to playoff times. Valanciunas was a monster last year in the playoffs and got hurt. It didn't really kind of work his way back in the Eastern Conference. If he's able to go out there and even do what he's doing now in the regular season, you know, 14 and 10 or whatever it is, and get a couple blocks, he can be that third guy. And then what we've all been discussing is that we know Toronto's defense has improved. So Valanciunas will be definitely be subbing in and out, you know, in those final 2 minutes of a close game where they can play Ibaka at the five, Tucker at the four, Carroll at the three, you know, Lowry, DeRozan, and those lineups out there. And you might see that offense for defense where, like, Carroll comes in for Valanciunas when they need defense, and Valanciunas comes in there and try to get a bucket down low. I think that's where we're at with Toronto. Again, they've made it a lot closer. They're not there yet. Again, I would never pick against LeBron James as long as he's healthy and has a team in the horse, if you will. A horse in the race, if you will.
And I wonder if this team will just go down as the they were really great, but they were just going to always be overshadowed by LeBron James.
It reminds me of the Pacers a few years ago, where they really went all in. They really could genuinely, like, I could see the Raptors taking the Cavaliers to seven, but I just can't see them getting over that hump and getting into the finals.
One of the other moves that I know you guys specifically over at the Baseline was probably paying good attention to, the Wizards and the Nets making a deal for Bogdanović and Chris McCullough, sending Marcus Thornton and Andrew Nicholson and a first round to Brooklyn. Do you think, from just an Eastern Conference, does this pickup of Bogdanović make the Wizards better than the Celtics? Or, you know, how big is this pickup for the Wizards as a whole and then in the Eastern Conference, you know, layout?
Well, I like it. I like it from Washington, and CL definitely has some strong comments about the Wizards in general, and all that they did. I still think they would have been better off with Lou Williams, and I guess they couldn't beat Houston to the punch, if you will, in terms of getting him, because they need help behind Wall and Beal, and Williams could have did both of those things. Williams can, you know, create a little bit on the handle of the ball at times. They're not happy with Trey Burke, and that's understandable. Bogdanović is more of a wing player, so he's going to back up Beal and back up Otto Porter. But it's a nice move because they needed bench depth. They absolutely needed to get something on the bench, so they did something. And I do think, in essence, I like the Celtics a lot. They're definitely, from a fan standpoint, my favorite team. But I was definitely afraid of what Washington's been doing, and I think Washington might already be better than Boston in terms of, you know, their ability to push, their ability to defend, and their ability to rebound. So now them getting a bench piece, I think it was a nice move for them in general. And again, we'll have to see what Boston does in the buyout market. But for me, Washington kind of is better. They've been playing better than Boston has been overall. But I still think, you know, when it comes down to the Eastern Conference, they're probably still second or third best.
Cal, I'll ask you, the Wizards, they still kind of need to worry about a backup point guard. Do you see them active in the free agent market?
Well, I don't know so much as they have to be active in the free agent market as much as I think they just need to allow some of these other point guards who are now going to start making themselves available, get picked up off the waiver wire, or, you know, try those guys out, guys like Mario Chalmers, Jaren Jackson. I mean, these are guys that are coming off of injury, and I think that if you need a veteran presence, somebody to help relieve minutes for John Wall and Bradley Beal, I mean, you know, fortune, you know, might ride the wave for these guys. And so, you know, to me, you know, it's interesting because on our show, you know, we had a really great analyst, insider, writes for the Wiz of Oz, Julie Smith. She was adamant about the fact that it would be great that they address the need of getting, you know, a backup point guard. And in my perspective, I felt like one of the needs that they were going to try and pull a trade off was to be able to address, you know, their front court, because I think that there's still light on the front court and they're still light on depth. So the fact that they got Bojan Bogdanović, I think, is one of the sleeper pickups for the Washington Wizards, because he has the versatility to play the shooting guard position. He also has the versatility to play that three position, and he gives them added scoring off the bench, something that the Washington Wizards sorely lack, and they're going to need it when they play up against teams, you know, in the playoffs. The other thing as well too is that you need a spot shooter in the half court set, and while you can rely on Bradley Beal, he's the type of guy who can also create on his own shot. Someone like a Bojan Bogdanović is kind of like the counter to the Kyle Korver for the Cleveland Cavaliers. You need that kind of guy on the basketball court. And I think that to me is one of the key things that people kind of miss when you're picking up a guy like that. And, of course, you know, if you're getting this guy on the cheap, he's like only worth $3 million. So, you know, I just like what the Washington Wizards did, because I think that they looked at the overall landscape and I feel like they know that they could probably find a better backup point guard than Ashtray Burke, you know, who's been doing nothing for this team, you know, at this particular moment in time. They can get a veteran guy to help relieve in those spot minutes for John Wall and Beal during the stretch run, but also, more importantly, get guys in their sets off their bench from a depth perspective when you relieve Wall and Beal off the basketball court and still give yourself a chance to score points, which is something that they are very inconsistent on in the second half of basketball games and, more importantly, in the fourth quarter. The moment those guys come off the floor, it's like a complete downtick in the Washington Wizards' offensive efficiency, and that needed to be addressed.
I know some Wizards fans were kind of happy they were able to get rid of Andrew Nicholson's contract as well, so I know that was pretty exciting, at least for guys who just didn't want him on the team anymore. Another trade that went down that you had just alluded to, the Rockets getting Lou Williams. Kevin, I'll pitch this over to you. It seems like the Rockets are just going straight up all offense, no defense. Who cares about guarding anybody? Let's just outshoot the Warriors.
Well, just in general with the Rockets, I think they kind of, like the Raptors, have really pushed themselves all in here. I think this team really thinks they can take it to the Warriors this year. To their credit, they have beaten the Warriors in the season. So, and the way they're playing, I mean, we saw a game against the Warriors with Denver the other week where Denver just bombed away and scored like 150-some points and just blew them out of the water. You know, it's a risky strategy, but they've doubled all in on Morey Ball. I mean, we saw their shot chart from the other night, their first game back after the All-Star break, and they legitimately took three mid-range jumpers the entire game. Like, it was all three-pointers and layups. It's impressive. And you look at that, you know, you look at how dynamic Harden is, and you look at how big of a punch Eric Gordon's been off the bench, and to come out and get another guy like Lou Williams, who we know can go off for, you know, have a 30-point night. He's capable of that. He's an excellent three-point shooter. He can get to the rack. He doesn't need the ball in his hands all the time. He just fits the model of what they're trying to do. It's we know D'Antoni wants to run. We know they're not as worried as much about defense, so they're going all in. The Rockets' game plan is to just outscore you. And you wonder, you know, come playoff time, you know, defense has cracked down a little bit. It's always been the argument with the Rockets is, you know, can Harden keep this blistering pace up in the playoffs once he starts getting double-teamed? You know, the more shooters they surround him with, so okay, you start to crack down on Harden, you start to crack down on guys like Eric Gordon, or maybe like a Ryan Anderson type, and you just put more shooters on the floor. So that just opens something up for Lou Williams. If you have all these guys who can consistently knock down the three-pointer, it makes it so much tougher on defenses to focus on just stopping James Harden or just stopping whoever's got the hot hand that game. So I really like this pickup for the Rockets a lot. Like Shaw had said, I thought this is the guy the Wizards should have gone after, but in terms of what the Rockets are trying to do, I think this was a really good pickup, and I think they maybe, I'm not sure that they're better than the Spurs yet, but I think they're right there in the mix. You know, the Rockets, the Spurs, and the Warriors are really the three teams who I think are going to be gunning for this Western Conference.
Kevin just kind of alluded to it, so I'll bring it over to Tim for this. Do you think the Rockets game is sustainable for the playoffs, where, you know, it has been known to slow down a bit and teams will definitely close out on players a little bit more? Do you think the Rockets can sustain this kind of play coming into playoffs, and I guess how far do you think it can take them?
Not to avoid your question, I just want to circle back really quick on the Wizards, because you asked about whether or not they were going to be active in the buyout market. Taking a look at their salary cap sheet right now, they are $7 million over cap, roughly $17 million over the salary floor, so I don't think we're going to see them be really active on the buyout market. As far as from, you know, is that sustainable? Look, Daryl Morey came out and said the other day that the only way that the Rockets are going to beat Golden State is by bombing threes. And it's paraphrasing, but that's pretty much what he said. He said, look, if we beat Golden State in the playoffs, it's going to be a 124 to 121 game. Mm-hmm. So I think they're going all in on that. I mean, to Kevin's point, they lead the league in three-point attempts at 40 three-point attempts a game. They're 11th in three-point percentage at 36%. Honestly, when the Lou Williams trade happened, I kind of felt like they were doubling down on something they were already good at, so it wasn't going to have the impact that maybe like a Serge Ibaka had for the Raptors, where they were filling a need. After watching, though, I think that Lou Williams is such a good complementary piece, and it really gives the Rockets, when James Harden isn't on the floor, a primary ball handler that is a threat. Mm-hmm. Which is really important, which is, you know, frankly, not something they had. I mean, Eric Gordon, he can handle the ball a little bit, but you don't want him running the offense. Patrick Beverley, you don't mind him running the offense, but he's not a threat. I mean, Lou Williams just, he absolutely balls out. I mean, whether or not they taking it back to the Raptors, the Rockets did, though, they gave themselves a punter's chance in the playoffs. And I think it's,
you're looking at teams, and I think we should be glad that teams are trying. Mm-hmm. You know, whether or not they actually can. There's so many teams that say, you know what, I'm not going to compete against the Cleveland Cavaliers. Shout out to Boston on that one. You know, I'm not going to try and compete with the Warriors, and shout out to the Clippers on that one, or San Antonio maybe. But I think it's really important that teams try, because that's why we're here. That's why we're watching this sport. And just to say, I'm going to nail it in for a year, mm-hmm. because the Golden State Warriors are so good. I just, you know, what is the point of playing basketball then?
Well, you know, Cal and or Warren, I'll let you guys jump back. And I guess if you were going to take the side of defending the Celtics against Tim's statement, how would you, or I guess why would you justify, or how would you justify the Celtics not wanting to, you know, I guess in a way mortgage their future?
To me, I just think that maybe Danny Ainge just has that much more faith in Brad Stevens to get these guys to play at a level that clearly a lot of people didn't expect them to be playing over the last couple of seasons. And, you know, to me, Danny Ainge is like the Ebenezer Scrooge of NBA draft picks right now. I mean, he hoards them, and, you know, I don't know, he somehow believes that through, you know, some Long Island medium-like style of basketball, you know, channeling, that, you know, all of this young talent that he's putting on this roster are going to suddenly become boys to men, and, you know, and help this basketball team to continue what many people believe is a level of overachievement. I look at this team, and I think this team is in the embodiment of what we didn't see happening back in the early 2000s when the Detroit Pistons came to fruition, right, with Chauncey Billups and Rip Hamilton and Rasheed Wallace and Ben Wallace, okay? Like, this is what I see with this Boston Celtics team, okay? What I saw from Chauncey Billups is what I'm now seeing from Isaiah Thomas. Chauncey Billups became that guy, right? And that's what Isaiah Thomas is becoming. And I just feel like this is a moment where you have lightning in a bottle and you need to take advantage of it. And so it's a little disheartening because you don't understand what the overall end game is with why Danny Ainge didn't pull the trigger on this move. Once again, I am not saying that the Boston Celtics absolutely had to make a play for Jimmy Butler, absolutely had to make a play for Paul George, if they are basically asking for a king's ransom. Mm-hmm. But there were more than enough players that were getting floated around. Brooke Lopez, I mean, just anybody that could help the abysmal front court play that we're seeing from the Boston Celtics. My God, Amir Johnson, right, who they keep hanging mm-hmm. on this guy. This guy is a bench player. He's not a starter. He had like 2 points, 5 rebounds, I think, or something like that, and about 18, 20 minutes of work. All I'm saying is that the Boston Celtics did themselves a disservice to not do anything to put themselves in a position to even make it look like they want to run with the team that seem to be, from an organizational perspective, getting ahead of the curve. The Masai Ujiri, right? The David Griffin. These guys are trying to get ahead of the curve, and they're trying to maintain their stance. And sometimes you just got to do it for the sake of doing it. Not for the fans, but just even for your organization and for the players. It builds up the players' morale when they see the organization going after it. They're not going to complain if they lose their boy, if whoever they're getting back is going to get them to the Eastern Conference Finals. They'll sing kumbayas and shake hands later on after the season's over. You know, get on a banana boat together and talk about the good times that they want to. But if you're the Boston Celtics, and I'm sorry I'm going on this rant about this, because to your point, Tim, it also lends to the credence about the mindset that some of these organizations are inhibiting upon themselves and also the players that they're signing, like the Sacramento Kings. It doesn't matter that you decided to give up DeMarcus Cousins. I don't want to go back to that trade. It doesn't matter that you do that. But what does happen is the impact of the trade and what you basically got back for him is saying what to the players that are still there, to the fans, and ultimately the countless people that are crunching the hours, burning the midnight oil, trying to make this a successful organization in the eyes of the NBA. What does that say? And again, that is on Vivek, that's on Vlade, that's an indictment when mm-hmm. you don't do it right. And to me, that's the line that Danny Ainge is treading right now by not doing something, what are you actually saying about the Boston Celtics and the organization and their competitiveness when it comes to the other teams in the Eastern Conference?
You know, you guys had mentioned that you didn't really blame them for not going after a Paul George. Given the new CBA, and I know that you guys are versed with this, because the same thing kind of happened with Paul George as it did with DeMarcus Cousins, where you have his agent going around telling people, look, if you trade for me, I'm not going to re-sign with you. I'm going to walk when my contract is over. So yeah, Paul George, who says, if you guys trade for me, and you know, basically we're talking about that Nets pick, if you guys trade for me, I'm going to walk to the Lakers. You know, what incentive does Danny Ainge have to trade such a valuable piece? Now, you can take that back to the Pelicans. Think about the Pelicans, though, is, you know, they gave up Buddy Hield. So who cares? But if you're talking about the Boston Celtics and that Nets pick, what incentive do you have to trade it for a guy like Paul George if his agent, you know, through the back channel says, we aren't going to re-sign with you?
Yeah, and that's a great point. And, you know, and I'll chime in really quick here. If any of you watch, like, the vertical Facebook feed, I think the night before the trade deadline, there was a sense that, you know, he said, well, Ainge's thinking is this, is like, I'm giving you a guy potentially in the 2017 first round pick that can be a franchise changer. And you want rotation guys, mm-hmm. and you want like half of my rotation as well. What ended up happening, and again, it does come back to Marcus Cousins a little bit, his trade messed up the entire market. Because
exactly.
Teams who were trying to get superstars were like, well, if Cousins went for that, why the hell am I going to pay X, Y, and Z? But still, guys like Larry Bird and then Paxton and Foreman in Chicago, they're like, well, say, these are our superstars, so we should get a King's ransom in return. And if you're Ainge or anybody else, you're like, well, hell no. Cousins went for Buddy Hield to be essentially a top 10 pick, perhaps. You know what I mean? So for me, that's why you kind of, I don't want to say you give him an excuse, but you give him a little bit of an out. Because, again, the market was really, really flubbed up. You saw the Brooklyn Nets. Their original asking price for Brooke Lopez was 2 first-rounders, like kick rocks.
Yeah.
Like that's not going to happen. Lopez is not half the player DeMarcus was. So you see something like that happen, it really messed things up this week with that DeMarcus Cousins trade.
And that was kind of like the whole like feel behind the trade deadline was, well, you know, Cousins went for this, so why am I going to give you all this? And there's just no reason. So it like it kept coming back to the Cousins trade.
Right, but I'm really interested what everyone thinks about the repercussions of the new CBA and how players are doing that now, where they're essentially handicapping franchises and saying and going around telling other franchises, don't trade for me, because, you know, it's to their credit, it's going to cost them $35, $40 million. I get it. What should the NBA do about this, if anything?
I am all for players getting paid, okay? What I'm not for is this Trump-like mentality that sports agents have been adopting.
Love it.
There's just loopholes that are giving them the access and the ability to pull off this kind of stuff without any repercussions or penalties. And the problem is, though, is that what they're doing, in essence, on the back end could possibly be sabotaging the ability for executives to do what is necessary, not just for with their own team, but also can affect the landscape of how we're seeing things take place and how transactions really should be done on a level of transparency. And then now we got to, you know, we spend more time on who's the good guy, who's the bad guy, than really just looking at the essence of the trade. I mean, you could strip it down for whatever you want. You got guys from the Sacramento Kings media who's like, yeah, you know, DeMarcus Cousins was a cancer. Name me a player who doesn't have an attitude, who hates half of his basketball team, who doesn't like to lose, that carries on like a baby on the basketball court, but still gives you 27 and 15. You get the right coach, you get the right organization, you can temper that part of it. What you can't temper is this air of other people who are enacting and enabling the true idea of why that player is still playing for that basketball team. And ultimately, to your point, handicapping these executives' ability to go out and maneuver and try to make comparable deals so that they don't get raked over the coals by the other teams. I mean, look, you can if people want, you can find a way to have an amicable trade to happen, and you can just hope that whatever happens on the long term, you wind up saying that trade impacted our organization, we wound up on the better part of the deal. Or you can essentially get Danny Ainge. You know what I mean? Like those type of trades where sending Kevin Garnett to the Boston Celtics and then them somehow getting Ray Allen, and you put together this great team for the next 3, 4, 5 years while the Minnesota Timberwolves, like, you know, wallow in the misery of you know, probably one of the worst trades. And now this DeMarcus Cousins trade is absolutely one of the worst trades, simply because we're letting outside entities that don't, that aren't supposed to have that much of an impact in this sense, are affecting that. And I think in the long term, if something like this doesn't get addressed, we're dangerously coming close to the type of stuff that we see even from a political landscape, you know, in general with society. This is how things operate, and it's not a good thing.
We'll switch it back to some of the other trades, because I mean, I completely agree, but I know at least on our side of the podcast, we've hit the Cousins trade so much, it's like beating a dead horse at this point for us.
I was chatting with Warren via Twitter, and so I was asking, you know, the guys from the baseline. I was like, hey, we don't really want to talk about Cousins because we've talked about Cousins twice now.
Right.
But if you guys want to work that into the conversation, I think Warren was like, nah, we good.
Yeah, it's just like, about two. It's just so much to talk about because it's like always there.
And the thing is, like, that Mark Spears interview came out, so there really is even more to talk about, but it's just I think we all know that the Kings got absolutely fleeced at this point. Like, it's pretty universally agreed on.
But I don't want the emphasis to be on the trade as much as it is
right.
The things that are happening in the back end of the trade, which again, these are things that are going to raise those questions, which is now going to indirectly revisit the whole idea of the trade. But the point to what you're talking about is that if we're also talking about this in the same context of what happened with Paul George, I mean, are we not to think that this exactly is what's going to happen for any other future superstar until something happens, until something changes with regards to, you know, to the CBA agreement? And I think this is just going to be the trend, unfortunately, until they close that loophole.
I mean, it's, and I don't, you know, I'm not a CBA expert. I don't know how you close that. I don't think,
because I thought they were locked in until
like
2022, right?
So it will be a trend. I mean, it also, the thing is, it's also going to be, it can only be a trend for players that are all NBA and how many of those players that there are. But it's just one of those things that, I mean, it's, you know, and I think it's a shame. Obviously, the Kings got fleeced, and I get that. I don't want to, you know, keep talking about it, but I just think it's important that as basketball analysts, we understand from the point of the organization what was available to them because of what agents are doing in the background.
Well, maybe it's going to be one of those, you know, man, a lighthearted take on it, though, but maybe the NBA sends one of those memos out like they did about, you know, not having the Twitter feeds. You know, kind of have that beef, but maybe they send something out to the agent, you know, kind of legal wise. Say, listen, you know what I mean, putting out, you know, these public notices, if you will, that X player will not do this or whatever the case be. That really is frowned upon. They don't have any legal right to do anything, and they can't impose it. But it might be something like, hey guys, at least like put the agents and people like that kind of on notice, if you will.
Yeah.
That's something that should be happening. And again, I don't know if anything more than that can be done.
And if I'm a Pacers fan, I am absolutely livid.
Yeah.
Paul George is out. He made it known he's out, and he's checked out mentally. And I think if you're like, how, as a Pacers fan, you know, how do you feel about Paul George? And then also as a Paul George teammates who he keeps trashing in the media, you know, saying how they aren't putting talented players around me. Look, they just signed Jeff Teague. What are you saying about your teammates when you're going out there and saying they aren't putting quality players around me? You're trashing your teammates.
Can we jump in here real quick and not to cut you off, Tim, but I just want to get everyone's opinion, because I'm of the mindset that Paul George is an amazing player. I just don't think he's the guy you want leading your franchise. I think he's a guy who can be your best scorer and things like that too, but I don't think he can be the face. He's not the superstar concept guy that I think a lot of people made him out to be. And to Tim's point, the things that he said all year have really put me on notice, like, that guy is something's off there with me. So I'm just trying to figure out how you guys feel about Paul George in general as a franchise.
Let me jump in real quick on that. It's funny how a tragic injury changes the mindset of some of these superstars, okay? Because we were saying the same thing about that with Derrick Rose. And now how many ACL tears, how many knee surgeries, and then we've seen what we've seen and heard from what we've heard from Derrick Rose over the last couple of years about his mindset and the business of the NBA now taking priority. Do we not think that that's probably the case with Paul George? I don't know if whether or not Paul George has those same aspirations that he had when he was about one or two games away from possibly playing in the NBA Finals when the Pacers were up against the Miami Heat, right? But you can clearly see that Paul George's mentality has clearly changed. I don't think that this is a question about him wanting to be, you know, the cornerstone piece of the franchise or anything like that. I think it's all about, you know, him realizing that he has one more solid contract left in him, given what has happened, and he doesn't have time to continue to play in a system that he's not happy with, to play for an organization that, I guess, from some level, there's still small marketability in them, even though the Indiana Pacers back in the heyday used to be that team next to the New York Knicks that can make equal headlines ultimately. I just feel like Paul George's mentality has changed. And much like a lot of these players, after a certain injury takes place, their priorities about wanting to win championships are not on the same level as what we see from guys like LeBron James and Dwayne Wade and those guys. They just don't have that in them, and they completely change that. And I think that should serve as a notice to the organization that you cannot sit here and think that you're just going to convince him, you know, and wave a magic wand. Guys don't have that temperament anymore, and organizations have to recognize that quickly and move accordingly.
You know, I mentioned them earlier, those Pacers teams that, you know, lest we forget, when Paul George was kind of really his coming out party, they were a game away from going to the NBA Finals. You know, so many years they were in the mix, just couldn't get over the hump with Miami. But really, you know, even since LeBron's left Miami, you wonder how frustrating it is to see other teams get better. You know, Boston to continue to accumulate assets, Toronto to get better, Washington to get better, you know, Atlanta to get better, where the Pacers haven't really got back into that mix. Now, I am concerned a little bit about Paul George. I mean, if you look at his numbers, you know, compared to where he was, they haven't really progressed too much the last few years. And if he's a superstar, you know, you ideally want him to get better every year. It's not like he's out of his prime. It's not like he's getting, you know, I mean, I know he's getting older, but it's not like he's on the wrong side of 30 or something. So, you know, I still think Paul George can be a number one option. I don't think it's going to happen in Indiana, but I would be a little concerned if I'm a buyer, because a lot of these comments seem like, you know, he's not happy, you know, he's not putting in the work anymore. You know, you wonder what it will take if you're another franchise for him to get back to that point, and then you're at the same position that the Pacers are at. So I think there's a little bit of those red flags, but I also think, you know, Paul George is happy again. You never know. Sometimes it is all about changing location for a player to, you know, get back right again and where he can be a dominant player and a true superstar for the next decade.
I kind of want to take it back to the trades. We got a little bit distracted there with some really good talk about the CBA, because I think there is a lot of underlying concerns that should be worried about, at least from like Adam Silver's standpoint and how the NBA goes forward from that. But one of the other trades that was probably one of the bigger ones that happened on actual trade day was the Bulls and the Thunder. And so I'm kind of going to try to do something here. Is I'm going to do it from each side. Tim, I'm going to give you from the Bulls perspective, and Warren, I'm going to give you from the Thunder perspective. The trade being Taj Gibson, Doug McDermott, and a 2018 second-round pick, and the Bulls receive Cameron Payne, Anthony Morrow, and LaVerne. So we'll start with Tim. How are your feelings for this trade going forward with the Bulls, and is there a clear direction, or does nobody really know what's going on?
From the Bulls' perspective, giving up on Doug McDermott, who they took a lot to get...
People compared him to Kyle Korver, like a younger Kyle Korver when he was coming into the league.
Well, and that's the thing. And so you have Bulls fans and people that watch the Bulls that are like, look, Doug McDermott, he can't defend worth a lick. All he can do is shoot. That's what he did in college. You know, and that's my same issue with everybody's like complaining about Jaw's inefficiencies now. And that's not Kevin, because Kevin was never on the Jaw. We need to draft Jaw boat. But everybody that's talking trash about Jaw is essentially saying, you know, he can't defend. Well, that's what he was in college, so why'd you draft him?
Yeah.
If you had an issue that, why'd you draft him? So looking at Doug McDermott, you know, the Bulls, they wanted to move on. They obviously have a ton of point guards. From OKC's side, and I know you don't want me to touch on that very much, but it matters, is that Cameron Payne, you know, he's been battling injury, but he hasn't had an opportunity to grow, right? And so from the Bulls' perspective, they looked at Cameron Payne and they said, you know what, we think that this guy can be a top 15 point guard. Maybe not this year, maybe not next year, but this guy can be a top 15 point guard. And so I get it. You know, I don't think they got much in return for Taj Gibson. He was an expiring deal. You should have traded him a year earlier. But look, they believe in Cameron Payne, and I don't think that you can fault them for believing in Cameron Payne. It's just, you know, if you don't look at it in a vacuum, the trade's a lot easier to digest from the Bulls' perspective.
How do you feel about, I mean, I guess from, you know, bringing on Morrow and LaVerne, do you think the Bulls are going to be able to use them effectively? I mean,
Morrow's,
I know,
an expiring contract.
I was going to say,
they're just trying to get rid of money. Mm-hmm. I do think that LaVerne is a really underrated player. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that LaVerne played last night when I was watching the game. I could be wrong. But, you know, I mean, he's essentially Mirotić. I like Laverne. You know, I don't think he stays around long term, though.
Okay.
So this was all about Cameron Payne.
Yeah, it was definitely a move to get Cameron Payne, which is so weird because they have so many point guards.
Well, like five?
Like five point guards. I'm sorry. It's just that's the only part I don't understand, but there. It's like
none of them are any good.
For a second, I'm like really surprised, Tim, by your just pretty okay with this with the Bulls. Like, what are the Bulls doing? Like, the Bulls don't have shooting. You trade Doug McDermott. He's literally the only shooter they have on the floor. Taj Gibson, okay, he's expiring. Like, that's fine. And Warren and Cal are about to get into the Thunder perspective. But I genuinely, like, you don't want to get young. You bring in Cameron Payne. You already have four point guards. But you keep saying you're going to sign these vets because you want to go with Dwayne Wade and go with Jimmy Butler. You didn't trade Jimmy Butler to go down for a full rebound.
They tried to trade Jimmy Butler. They offered Jimmy Butler to the Suns for Devin Booker.
It's just, what is it going to take for the Bulls to tear it down? Like, they just, and I don't understand, when you have no shooting, you trade the only shooter you have.
I'm not arguing that. I think from the Bulls, I'm trying to look at it from the Bulls' perspective, and the Bulls' perspective is that they believed in Cameron
Payne.
Yeah,
no, I get that. They're taking the chance on Cameron Payne as their guy going forward. Like, I understand that logic. I just don't understand what they gave up for him, and I don't really, like, I think the franchise, you know, we talk about the Kings and we talk about the Knicks. I think the Bulls are kind of in that, like, holy trinity of dysfunction right now. Like, I don't think they have a clear game plan at all of what they're trying to do and what their blueprint to win is.
I mean, I agree. If you want to talk about how many point guards they got, like, how many of those guys are going to be on the roster in 2 years? Rondo? No. Isaiah Cannon, Michael Carter-Williams, Jerian Grant? Like, how many of those guys are going to... None of those are franchise point guards.
But why not tear it down and draft somebody is what I'm saying.
I mean, fine. That's a whole other argument you can make. Sure, they should have done that. They didn't. So we're looking at this right here. You know?
But, I mean, I think the issue that, like, from an outsider's point is, they're valuing Cameron Payne like the Kings valued Buddy Hield. Like, come on, son. You know, Payne is...
Well, they didn't give up DeMarcus Cousins for Cameron Payne. I mean, come on. they gave up Doug McDermott.
But CL will take me over the coal for it a little bit. You know, but by, for 36-minute averages, Cameron Payne is, like, 11-4-3. So even if you're giving him starters minutes, I know he hasn't lived up to his hype per se, and then maybe they see something that, you know, the rest of us don't. But it's a very interesting trade, I think, for Chicago, and their direction does seem to be a little bit wary, if you will. But again, for OKC, I think, you know, they did the best that they could do. This move allows them to compete for home court advantage in this year's playoffs. Yes, Gibson is an expiring deal, so if, you know, for whatever reason, it doesn't work out. Or, you know, maybe they try to resign him, and maybe they try to move Cantor over the summer, something like that, because that's a rumor that they've been trying to do. They still need to address the small forward issue. McDermott, I don't think, is going to be a plug-and-play as a starter in that lineup at that small forward position, but he's definitely an upgrade over Morrow, who is giving them nothing, and Kyle Singler and all those guys who just give them nothing at the small forward position. So Roberson, you know, I know there's some issue about whether or not they're going to re-sign him, but McDermott can come in there and play some nice minutes, and Gibson should be fine too. They got Cantor back, quicker than I thought they would. So it'll be interesting to see how they all mesh together in those lineups. But I think they were both out there on the floor in their first game together, Cantor and Gibson. And again, it played well. And Westbrook seemed to be happy to maybe did not. He did shoot well, but he seemed to not be happy to not have to shoulder load as much offensively. Can, you know, do a lot of pick and roll and even pick and pop with Taj Gibson as well. So for me, I think OKC definitely got the better end of this deal. And again, they don't have to commit a lot of money to Taj Gibson if they don't want to keep him.
That's what I was thinking too, especially Taj Gibson. One of the first things I thought was, well, he kind of fits perfectly with, like, the way that Steven Adams plays. They just kind of are bullies down low and can really just, like, bang down low, and that just kind of fits right in. And my thinking with Doug McDermott is he's a three-point shooter, so that will kind of space the floor a little bit more for Westbrook and Oladipo when they're trying to slash and drive the paint. And so it made sense for me as well. I kind of liked it from OKC's side.
Well, also,
and they got a pick.
Yeah, and a pick.
Right.
That's the thing. I don't know why Chicago gave him a pick on top of it. That's really been the sticking point. Why was the pick involved at all?
He didn't need it. I mean, that's honestly a great question, though. You know, like, do you think the value was that low that they had to throw in a pick?
It's a second round pick. It was
2018.
Oh, well, I mean, you know, I mean, like candy. It's like candy bars giving out a second round picks. Who cares? I would say that Taj Gibson can do one thing that Enes Kanter can't, that OKC needs, and that is somebody that can defend a pick and roll.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that'll be really valuable during the playoffs.
That'll be interesting. And I know it. I think for sure with Westbrook and the way that they play, getting a home court advantage in the playoffs will definitely be pretty huge for them, in my opinion.
They can chase them down.
Yeah, exactly. So we're going to switch over to the one trade that I know our co-host over here, Kevin Rafuse, has been waiting for since we started. I saved it for last because I have a feeling he's going to set fire to this entire studio, and I didn't want to lose all of our recording. The Mavs and the Sixers did a trade where Justin Anderson, Andrew Bogut, and a protected first round went to Philadelphia for Nerlens Noel, Kevin I Step Back. Guys from the baseline, if you guys want to jump in and comment right after Kevin, and if you disagree with something, feel free to jump in because he's about to set fire.
Actually, I have no intent of jumping in after Kevin, in front of Kevin, around Kevin, near Kevin. You know,
I've been waiting for 3 days to record this podcast. So let's talk about the last month of the Philadelphia 76ers, because about a month ago, things were pretty good. Everybody, like, a lot of goodwill. Dario's balling.
Hold on. We did win last night.
We did win last night. Joel Embiid looks like everything we hoped he'd be once he's healthy. The fans are excited. The organization is moving in the right direction. Going into the trade deadline, the first deal we made was the Ilyasova deal for 2 second rounders to free up Dario Saric. And you know what? I said, that's a pretty good deal. All right. I was just so ready to give Brian Colangelo some credit. However, no disrespect to Brett, no disrespect to the players, but the Sixers organization the last month has been an absolute dumpster fire. And the whole reason that they billed us on bringing Brian Colangelo in was so the organization would be more transparent. So let's talk about how transparent we've been. Joel Embiid apparently had a partially torn meniscus that he suffered during Portland. So for some reason, they decided to play him on national TV against Houston a week later, and then announced 2 or 3 weeks later, only when it got leaked to Derek Bodner, that, oh yeah, by the way, Embiid, he may or may not have a torn meniscus, so we don't know when exactly he's going to be back. Now, apparently, he's coming back on March 3rd. I don't even know if we can believe that at this point. Ben Simmons has been billed to come back after the All-Star game. They've been showing him off, getting him ready. And I'm all about keeping Ben around the team. Let me preface this by saying, I am all for taking the utmost caution with Embiid and Ben Simmons. This is your franchise going forward. You take every precaution to make sure they have the longest and healthiest careers possible. But the Sixers organization was dropping hints that it would be after the All-Star break, and they were raising ticket prices for certain games. And now yesterday, only when it's pushed that, oh, by the way, Ben Simmons, his foot's a little broken and it's not healing the right way, so he's not going to play the rest of the season. Only after he got pressed. So let's go into this deal and how just much of a cluster F that this deadline has been. So first you pull Jahlil Okafor from 2 games because you say he's on the verge of getting traded, and then you just randomly insert him back into the lineup in Boston, and now you awkwardly have to pave over the fact that, you know, you were on the verge of trading this dude, you publicly admitted it to everyone, and now he's got to play with you guys for the rest of the season. It's well documented that I think Jahlil Okafor is a horrible basketball player. However, you don't treat your people like this, period, and if you don't have a deal done, you don't pull him from the lineup, or you better get the deal done and trade him. Ja was the type of player that you could trade for 25 cents on the dollar. Instead, Colangelo all time has been just mouthing, yeah, we got to get it done. Yeah, we got to get it done. Yeah, we got to get it done. So he gets this deal with the Mavericks. Nerlens Noel, who's played himself back in the lineup, has genuinely played a ton of quality minutes for this team, who, yeah, maybe you aren't going to pay him long term and that you think you don't want to max out a guy who's going to be 20 minutes as a backup for Embiid every night. I understand that. I'm okay with that. But why not re-sign him in restricted free agency and then move him? But Brian Colangelo said, oh, he wasn't in the plans. Like, so he just completely misplayed his hand. And then you trade him to the Mavericks, which the Mavericks won. Like, this is phenomenal for the Mavericks. This is a guy they can build around for, you know, we talk about they've been missing a guy since Tyson Chandler. Here's your Tyson Chandler. I mean, what a pickup for them. So instead, you get Justin Anderson, who, mind you, I don't think is an awful prospect. I think he's a decent defender. His shooting concerns me a little bit. But he's a mid-tier prospect at best. Bogut, who is going to get bought out. And then what just really bothers me about the way this is handled is they're selling on this protected first-round pick. They build the press release with the first-round pick, which is 1 through 18 protected this year, and then it turns into 2 seconds in 2018. That first-round pick is not going to convey this year. The Mavericks are not going to win every game for the rest of the season and jump the Thunder, who I think are 7.5 ahead of them as of recording this podcast. So in other words, you basically come out and insulted our intelligence by billing the press release with, oh, we got a first rounder, everything's fine. Brian Colangelo is a moron. He completely botched this trade deadline. And so, you know what? We mentioned Trumpism a little bit earlier. You know, I from this podcast forward, am not calling Brian Colangelo Brian Colangelo anymore. He's strictly Lion Colangelo to me. They have offended us who have been putting up with all this for the last years. And it's a total mess. This is not how an organization is. And the worst part is, Hinkie still set him up so well that they're probably going to be good anyway. In the grand scheme of things, the Nerlens Noel trade is not the end of the world. You've got Rashawn Holmes, who looks like he could be a capable backup. You move Ja for pennies on the dollar. The Kings pick has all sorts of value now because of them trading Boogie. You've got the Lakers pick, which is either going to convey this year or next year. And you very well, because you're going to suck the rest of the season, can probably get a number one or number two pick and get your point guard of the future. Like, that's the worst part in all this, is that Colangelo is going to get to see the fruits of all this labor. Because I just think, like, this has reaffirmed our worst fears and what I hoped wasn't true. Brian Colangelo is okay at drafting talent, but he has no idea how to manipulate the market. And make no bones about it, the Mavs absolutely fleeced him. This is a robbery with no gun for Dallas.
I got to say, the whole time you were talking, I was thinking that My Heart Will Go On by Celine Dion. I just felt like that should be behind the entire rant.
Well, and on top of that, like, Nerlens Noel is the one guy who's been here the entire process. Like, he's really put up with a lot, and they didn't even try to play him and Embiid together. Like, the first half of the season, the Sixers tried so hard to play Embiid and Okafor together, despite the fact that it was an absolute monstrosity on every aspect of them playing, to the point where Brett Brown finally said, yo, we can't do this anymore. Like, we're not going to win games. They played Nerlens Noel for 8 minutes. And in those 8 minutes alone, it looked better than it did with Ja. Like, you didn't even give it a chance. That's what bothers me. Know your value. Know, even if you max him next year, if somebody wants to give Nerlens Noel a max, match it and then trade him. It's just, it seems like a complete misunderstanding of how to do business transactions in the NBA. And that's what you were afraid of when they hired Brian Colangelo, because this was a problem in Toronto, and it just seems like it's rearing its head again. It's a total misplay, and the press conference that he held yesterday, it gave me no faith that he has any idea what to do on the business transaction. So again, like I said, we're set up well, but, you know, Lion Brian, that's his nickname in Philly. He's Lion Brian.
Cal and Warren, I'll let you guys take it from the other side. I know Kevin mentioned that the Mavs definitely won this and fleeced the Sixers, but how big and how great of a move was this for the Mavs? Or do you think it was a bad move on their end? Because it is a little bit of a risky. Noel does have some injury concerns. So how do you see it from the Mavs side?
Well, I think the Dallas Mavericks did what was necessary to preserve some opportunity, I guess you could say, for Dirk Nowitzki to, you know, to have a chance maybe of making the playoffs. I mean, you know, as they sit, they're only like a couple of games out of the eighth seed. So, you know, look, Mark Cuban looks at Dirk Nowitzki like Jerry Jones looks at Tony Romo, and he's going to basically sell out as much as he can to give Dirk, you know, the proper send-off. Because, I mean, long-term, I don't really know how much longer the Dallas Mavericks can continue to keep playing with supplemental parts. Mm-hmm. Aaron Williams, you know, like at some particular point, you just have to commit at getting young. And I think on both fronts, getting a guy like Nerlens Noel certainly puts them in that direction. So, I you know, and I feel bad because as much as Kevin, you know, got on the pulpit and came down with the thunder, there's absolute truth in this, in the sense that it's one thing when you trade a player like Nerlens Noel, because clearly, you know, one of the biggest pet peeves that I've had about the 76ers is just they are completely overloaded in that front court, and
right,
it's really hard for you to properly gauge on what a person's talent level is just because of where he got traded, and not so much what he's done over the last few seasons. I feel like the 76ers have done a disservice to Nerlens Noel and what you could possibly see in his potential. Now, clearly the Dallas Mavericks saw past that, but I just think that they flat out recognized that they needed to commit something early on the front court. They couldn't continue to play Dirk Nowitzki at the five. And I think amongst all of the other options that were out there in bigs, and, you know, we go back again, unfortunately, to the precedent that was set with the mm-hmm. DeMarcus Cousins trade, the Dallas Mavericks felt like, you know what, we could probably get get best of both worlds and a guy like Nerlens Noel. I think more than anything, I was just more surprised by the fact that the 76ers felt the need to shop more Nerlens Noel than a Jahlil Okafor. I felt that the Mavericks could have easily been satisfied with probably playing, you know, getting a Jahlil Okafor more so than a Nerlens Noel. But I think they got the better of the two players,
mm-hmm.
what they need at this immediate moment, especially with a coach like Rick Carlisle.
Yeah, and I was going to say, I think, you know, to your point of saying that the Mavs were able to see, you know, past Noel's playing with the Sixers, I think I saw he's, like, total minutes, he's only played, like, around 5,000 minutes his entire career in the NBA or something like that, which is just insane to me because he's been there for a bit, so that's just kind of surprising. But, yeah, I definitely think the Mavs went in the right direction with getting Noel.
They did, and, you know, really quickly, I think, you know, what Kevin said earlier, that what ended up happening is they absolutely flubbed up Okafor's value
mm-hmm.
and then had to pivot and then say, all right, well, we got to do something at the deadline, get rid of one of these dudes, and it ended up being Noel. And again, all basketball minds out there feel like Noel is a better player, and again, there's no disagreement with that currently.
Yep.
But again, the Mavs do exactly what they wanted to do, and they got exactly the type of player that Rick Carlisle likes in their system. And again, you just have to hope that they can re-sign him this summer as restricted free agent, and, you know, that they have no issues with that otherwise, and it becomes a wash for all teams. But yeah, it really does suck for Philadelphia fans, you know, who really basically now get more second rounders, you know, as we've been talking about the value of these second rounders, but the Sixers have been just accumulating second round picks for whatever reason for the last couple of seasons.
Yeah.
And that's really the unfortunate part of it, because Noel should have netted them a bigger game, but because they plugged up the whole Okafor thing, then they had to pivot. And that to me is where Calandro really missed the boat on this one.
Right, and I guess we're kind of getting towards the end here, but I really, just one last comment, at least from my side, I really do like the idea of Harrison Barnes and Noel going forward for them. But there was one more storyline that we can all just hit real quick, and then we can get out of here. That
JaVale McGee?
No. But although that is a good storyline, so we can hit that too. I guess I understand Derrick Rose was really good for the Bulls, but he kind of left on not great terms and stuff like that, and so this whole thing that's going on with Anthony Morrow wearing number one, or was going to wear number one, and Bulls fans freaked. We're saying, you can't do that. That's Derrick Rose's number. So he actually went to Twitter and literally tweeted, no disrespect to the Chicago's fan. I had no idea that y'all felt this way about number one. I swear I wouldn't have chose it if I knew that was going to be a problem. I'm sorry. So are you guys surprised from the Bulls fans' reaction of Anthony Morrow wanting to wear the number one?
You know it's all bad when Bulls fans have got nothing better to do with their time in their life. They have no interest in watching the Chicago Bulls play basketball. If they basically want to head up on Twitter, on Instagram, you know, probably you go to town hall meetings demanding that Anthony Morrow find another jersey to wear, because it was a former basketball player who they used to chastise and berate to begin with anyway. So, I mean, yeah, that Chicago Bulls fans are kind of special right now. They're kind of special.
I mean, it's just like Derrick Rose. I feel like if you're a Chicago fan, you have to appreciate the MVP year and a few other things that Derrick Rose gave you. Like, it's not like I feel like their goodbye with Derrick Rose in Chicago was just awkward more than anything, because Jimmy Butler started to emerge, and then Derrick Rose was getting paid a lot of money, and he came back from the injuries, and they were so thrilled, but they just kind of realized that he was never going to be old Derrick Rose, and they wanted the team to go around Butler. Like, I feel like it wasn't malicious. It was just kind of awkward.
Well, I agree, and I'm stunned to even hear things like that come about, because you'd figure, you know, whatever, he's gone, you know, it didn't work out the way that everyone would have hoped, but to see that the fan base, if you will, is still has those ties and whatever, and maybe that's the Chicago native in him. But Rose seems to have something around the league, because even the fact that Thibodeau wanted him back, and I understand that, you know, you might need to upgrade over Rubio, but, you know, dealing with that for 7 years in Chicago, why would you want to bring that back even for 25 games if you're Tibbs? So to me, whatever, Rose has some sort of lore in the NBA, and he's romanticized people in a way that, again, it seems to be a workout in his favor.
Well, we wanted to give you guys a huge shout out for coming on with us and doing this roundtable. It was a great, because there was so much trade deadline to dissect, so we definitely needed some extra help, and bringing you guys on was a blast for sure.
Great when you sit down, you collaborate with great minds, great personalities, and, you know, I'm just fortunate I know Shaw will probably chime in on this one, but I'm just fortunate to be around some really great people, man, to have opportunity to discuss, you know, some of these crazy storylines that have taken place, you know. So I just feel bad for Anthony Morrow, though. I that boy just can't catch a break for the life of him, man. I'm sure he's looking back saying, I should never drop that 50 for Golden State. My life has never been the same since.
That is one of the more the only more random 50-point game than that for me is, do you guys remember, I think it was in 2011 or 2010, Andre Miller was on the Trailblazers, and he just dropped like 52 points in one game.
Yeah.
Like, I think his previous career high was like 28.
I remember that team. It's like, what's happening? People
thought that it was Reggie Miller that he came back, you know, back and started playing with the NBA. I don't think anybody was ever thinking it was an Andre Miller. So
one of the more bizarre moments. But, we appreciate you guys coming on as always. You know, we love the Drive and Dish NBA podcast and Baseline podcast collaborative episodes. Make sure you follow both of our shows at Drive and Dish NBA. Make sure you follow the Baseline at NBA Baseline. Make sure you follow Cal at Game Face Lee, Warren at Shaw Sports NBA. And you can follow the three of us, myself, Kevin. I'm at Refuse to Lose. Tim is at Radio Tim NBA. And Justin is at Justin C on the air. So make sure you give all of us a follow, and you can continue to hear us get our takes off.
It's an amazing time, and I'll go back to watching or get my game up here on April the draft and see what's popping.
Yeah, dude, she's literally been in labor for like almost a week.
It's well, like, at least I didn't miss anything.
Right? I just feel so bad.
I think we've done enough dancing for today. So why don't we dance Wednesday?
See you, Star Side.
Okay, well, I'm out of here.
Get in the hole!
Da, 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 da. Hey! Da, 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 da. Hey!
Let's go while we're young!
All right, I think they get the point.